Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a Roman history podcast from La Trobe University. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me today is Dr. Rhiannon Evans, Associate Professor in Classics and Ancient History at La Trobe University. This is episode CXLII, Deification. When an emperor passed away, it gave the Roman Empire a chance to reflect on his reign. If he wasn't terrible and the circumstances allowed it, he might be deified and worshipped as a god throughout the empire. What made a Roman emperor good? As we shall see, the bar was fairly low. Here's Rhiannon Evans.
Deification is basically turning a human into a god. So sometimes called apotheosis, which is just the fancy Greek name. The process is not that common, although as we'll see, it becomes more common in the Roman context. Because it's a controversial thing to do. It's basically breaking the boundaries. Normal people die. Some special people become gods, which basically means they haven't died. They're not in the land of the dead. They have joined the gods. They've gone up rather than down.
Now, we talk about it a lot in the podcast, but that is because it's a podcast, in theory, about emperors of Rome. I know we tend to take detours quite a lot, but when you're talking about emperors, it's something that happened to emperors. But besides that, it wasn't all that common in the Roman context, was it?
No. Eventually, members of the imperial family might be deified too, or people who are really close to them, like Hadrian's,
yeah.
Deifying Antinous. But it's something that is, like a lot of honours in the imperial period, kept for the imperial family, particularly the emperor. And it becomes a kind of touchstone of whether you're a popular emperor or not. If you're not deified, it almost becomes a travesty. It means that something's gone badly wrong during your reign. But the important thing to note is in the Roman context, it only happens after death, even though I've said it technically means you haven't died.
Yeah.
The Romans don't deify living figures.
No, but an emperor might kind of set the groundwork for himself to be deified. That's something that does happen and that we will discuss as well. It's also something that a emperor will use to solidify his position. So they might deify the predecessor.
Yeah, exactly. To ensure that they look legitimate because they become the son of a god. Look, I mean, for a long time, emperors have to be careful with this because... Sorry, I'm going off script a bit here.
That's fine.
Tell me if it's if you think it shouldn't fit here. Because
go off script.
Because Julius Caesar had been accused of both acting like a king and almost acting like he was a god while he was still alive, you know, wearing his triumphal garb, which sort of turns you into almost Jupiter for the day, wearing that as a matter of course. And that is one of the things that sort of pushed the Senate maybe towards assassinating him. So if you look too close to being a god while you're still alive, then that could be dangerous. Similarly, people said things like that about people like Caligula and Domitian, that they acted like they were gods and they both get murdered. It's a line you have to walk, even as an emperor. But really, it mustn't even look like it's happening until you're gone.
So the leaders becoming gods isn't a purely Roman concept. We've got evidence of it in the classical world before, or even before that, really. You've got Egyptian pharaohs just flat out being gods on earth while they are ruling. And then you've got the Greeks kind of dabbling with the concept, but mostly in mythology until it kind of ventures out of it. Off you go.
Yeah, with the Egyptians, and this is one of the reasons that the Greeks and Romans sort of look slightly askance, because the Egyptians have done it in a full-blown way. For the Greeks, it has apparently happened to several mythological figures. The most famous one is Heracles, Hercules for the Romans. But in their literature, that's often shown to be something exceptional. Like, he's a son of Zeus, but Zeus has loads of sons and they don't all become gods. Heracles is kind of exceptional even in mythological circles. But really, I think the game changer is Alexander the Great, who is not a mythological figure, who was a real life Macedonian king. He is deified, probably influenced by the fact that he conquers areas, including Egypt, where this has happened to living figures.
And he takes on their mythology to some extent. But you use the word deified there. Is that the correct word that the Greeks were using? Or
deify comes from the Latin term, from the Latin word deus.
What would the Greeks have called?
The Greeks would have called it apotheosis.
Okay, yeah.
Apotheosizing, but it's really difficult to work that into an English verb.
Yeah.
Apotheosizing. I don't think I've ever seen that written down. there were claims, I think even during Alexander's lifetime, that he was a son of Zeus as well. Mm. All right, so that Philip II wasn't actually his father. Zeus was his father, and this obviously upped his claim to deification. Really, Alexander, I think, sets the standard, because the reason it can seem natural, or at least not out of the question to deify him, is what he seems to achieve in terms of his conquest is just so exceptional. It's, you know, he conquers a huge territorial empire and dies in his early 30s.
So he couldn't be anything else but a god.
Yeah, that's almost the idea, that no ordinary person can aspire to this, but he's a very extraordinary person.
Sure. Okay. All right. I'll buy that. Godhood. All right. So how does it come to arise then in the Roman context? We really go back to the founding days of Rome here to go to our first example of deification, even if it is as retroactively enforced.
Yeah. So again, it belongs in the mythological world, really. Romulus, the founder of Rome, is technically the first Roman to be deified. I suppose you could say that it seems to have happened to Aeneas too, the founder of the Romans. But let's start with Romulus. He is supposed to have been the founder of Rome, founded in 753 BCE, but this is very much a legendary history. If he lived, it was in the 8th century. We think that the deification process didn't actually happen until the 4th century BC. So it's part of this consolidation of Rome as this place that's given this authority by the gods. Because Romulus is a son of Mars.
Yep.
So it makes sense to deify him. When he's deified, he's apparently called Quirinus. Now, this seems to be some way of rationalizing two different gods who were important to the city of Rome. So there's a temple of Quirinus on the Quirinal Hill in Rome, and he's somehow merged with Romulus as his deified form. And we do have a description in Livy, the Augustan historian, in book one, who does the whole kind of history of Rome from beginning to his own time, where he tells us the sort of process of this. He says in book one, chapter 16, the people greeted him, Romulus, as a god who was descended from a god and as king and father of Rome, and asked him in their prayers to be always favorable and willing to preserve his descendants.
Livy 1:16:3. That makes it sound like it was very much a popular vote kind of thing.
Yeah. Wow. So it has to be ratified by the Senate, certainly later on. So there's an idea that that has happened too.
Yeah.
But yes, that there's a kind of call for, it's almost a continued protection and a way of honouring and remembering this figure. That is the idea of what happened. But obviously Livy says it's happening right back in the 8th century, whereas we think it happened much later.
This
process of turning him into a god.
Okay, so that's what I meant by retroactively as well. So we've got that, which is, okay, it's a real person being deified, sure, Romans, but it's almost mythological as well.
It's very much mythological.
Okay,
personally, I don't believe Romulus existed.
Okay, all right.
I don't know if that's controversial.
No. Look, I just wanted to make sure that we're on the right page here, not doubting the Romans at all. But anyway, so that's a mythological, but for the Romans, that would have been a real person being deified kind of thing. What is the first real person being regarded as a deified god, kind of?
The Romans sort of muddy the waters for a little bit, I have to say. They are very unwilling to deify real people, and certainly always unwilling to have this happen while they're alive. Mm. So throughout the late Republic, you have these people who are sort of largely seen as saviors of Rome, or maybe tagged as saviors of other people, who get almost religious honors. And starting even in the mid-Roman Republic, they're successful military leaders. Military leaders like Marcellus, Flaminius, and then Marius, who saves Rome from the Gallic invasion of the late 2nd century BCE. Mm. Now, they're not deified. There's no cults. There's no temples. They do receive offerings of food and drink in Roman households along with the other gods. And we know this from Plutarch, who tells us this in his Life of Marius, chapter 27. So they're kind of on the way to being semi-deified. It's no official process. It's a way of remembering and giving thanks, I guess. You know, the Gauls didn't come and destroy our city in the case of Marius.
Yeah.
So the first to be deified is Julius Caesar. No surprise there. The man who broke barriers all over the place.
That's formal deification at that point, where they're just blatantly going, this guy is now a god. So before his death, as you said at the top of the podcast, he was kind of setting the groundwork, perhaps unintentionally, but maybe seeing how far he could push things.
There's a lot of that with Caesar, isn't it? We've talked about that in other podcasts, that he does seem to be pushing the boundaries towards kingship.
Yeah.
And similarly, there were claims, and this is, you know, largely claims against Caesar, that he had received divine honors while he was dictator. So remember, he becomes dictator forever, right, mm-hmm. in the last year of his life. But there's a statue of him put in the temple of Quirinus, who, remember, was Romulus. A deified figure.
Yeah, yeah.
So is he almost on a par? You know, this having a statue of you in a religious setting. The inscription there under his statue was "to the unconquered god."
Yeah,
which,
okay.
You know, seems quite clear that he was on that path. His face appeared on Roman coins, which was not typical for living Romans. And I think we can see this as one of the things that leads to people feeling that Caesar has gone beyond what he should in terms of his authority and honor. But it doesn't stop him from being deified after his death, largely due to the fact that Octavian pushes for this gets it through a very sympathetic Senate.
This is what we were saying at the top as well, that this is beneficial for Octavian Augustus to promote himself and solidify his rule as being the son of a god.
Yeah, and he puts that on coins.
Oh, yeah.
Divi filius, son of a god.
Yes, yep.
Maybe a good description here is from Suetonius in The Life of Caesar, right at the end, of course, chapter 88. Longish quote, "He died in the 56th year of his age and was numbered among the gods." There's a deification.
There you go. Yep.
"Not only by formal decree," that means of the Senate, "but also in the conviction of the common people." So the ordinary people wanted it. They clamored for it.
Mm-hmm.
"For at the first of the games which his heir Augustus gave in honor of his apotheosis, a comet shone for 7 successive days, rising above the 11th hour, and was believed to be the soul of Caesar, who had been taken to heaven. And this is why a star is set upon the crown of his head in his statue."
Mm.
Okay. That also appears on coins. You see coins with a little star above Caesar's head. And this was really lucky that this happened at the funeral games.
The timing of the comet.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
definitely.
They could not know that was going
to
happen.
You will attribute that to a god. So what does it mean now that Caesar is a full-blown god?
So from January 42, so 2 years after his death almost, he is a god. And that means that there will be a temple of the deified Caesar.
Mm-hmm.
There will be a bust of Caesar carried with gods in procession on festival days. There will be festivals to Caesar, rituals carried out. There'll be a priest.
Wow, so it's just all the trappings that come with the god.
A slightly macabre detail that we get from Suetonius is that at the time Octavian carried out human sacrifice to honour Caesar, which is not common in the Roman world. 300 senators and equestrians selected from those who had surrendered after the Battle of Perusia in 41 BCE to be slaughtered like sacrificial victims on the Ides of March and an altar dedicated to the divine Julius.
Wow.
That's a big deal.
That's human sacrifice.
Yeah.
Which you don't often hear about with Romans doing.
And the Romans, when they talk about barbarians doing it, like Caesar talks about the Gauls carrying that out in Book 6 of the Gallic War.
Yeah.
It still doesn't seem very common, but, you know, there's an implication that that's pretty barbaric.
Yeah.
And this is kind of revenge as well, getting 300 your enemy, making an example of them in a very real way.
I guess so. It's like, you know, well, if we've got to execute them, I might as well, you know, do it to my deified dad. Okay. All right. So how does Augustus approach deification then? Because Caesar has been deified. Augustus kind of realizes that this is the sort of thing that I can set myself up for during my lifetime.
I guess so. It's more the way other people start to talk about it.
Okay.
So there are 2 things that go on, I think. It's very clear, certainly by, say, the very end of the first century BCE and the early first century. So Augustus dies in 14 CE.
Hmm.
But we have people like Ovid in the Metamorphoses, which is published in 8 CE, talking about it like it's a certainty and saying at the end of the Metamorphoses in book 15, please don't die too soon, you know, don't become a god too soon.
Yeah.
Like, okay. That's just going to happen. He knows it. But Augustus himself had been doing something really clever throughout his reign, and that is he had not been setting up altars to himself, because that is just too dangerous.
But you had an altars to Augustan peace. You had the Areopagus.
Yeah,
so just to concepts of it, reinforcing his name, reinforcing the work that he's done.
Basically turning his name into an adjective that you attach to gods. Mm. So the goddess peace It's now Augustine peace. And doing it systematically throughout the empire so that there is a state cult of the Augustan Lares. And the Lares are the household gods of every household. But now it's like there is an overall household that is over the Roman Empire that is the Augustan household. So this isn't praying to Augustus, but it's praying to gods who take care of Augustus and his household. And the Augustan Genius, who's kind of the guardian god of Augustus.
This comes up at the end of the first book of the Fasti, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And that's something that Ovid notes, that this change has happened. And you sacrifice a bull to the Genius of Augustus. So normally it's something that someone might do as an individual for their own Genius or their own household gods.
Yeah.
But now everyone's doing it for Augustus's household gods. So not deification, but it's sort of on the way there. As I say, very clever fence sitting from Augustus. He knew how to play the game.
Well, he's got a nice long rule to kind of work it all out as well.
Yeah. Yeah, he gets lucky with that. So you're not honouring Augustus exactly. It's not exactly deifying him, but you're honouring Augustinized versions of gods who already exist. This is his genius, I think, not to pun with the Genius that is his guardian god, is that he either uses or pretends he's using forms that already exist.
Yeah.
I'm not making any changes. This is tradition. But let's just add the word Augustan to it. And it changes the whole manner of it.
So once he dies, Tiberius really leans into it. It has him deified rather quickly at essentially the funeral.
Yeah, and there's all of this symbolism. They can't rely on another comet, I guess. And when he's cremated, an eagle is released to symbolize the soul going up to heaven.
It's a very long, when you read it from Dio, very long eulogy. It has like 6 chapters of what Tiberius says at the funeral. Good, but, you know, just maybe read out the last bit of it there.
Okay. From
Dio, book 56, chapter 42.
According to Dio, Tiberius said, "It was for all this, therefore, that you, with good reason, made him your leader and a father of the people, that you honoured him with many marks of esteem and with ever so many consulships, and that you finally made him a demigod and declared him to be immortal. Hence it is fitting also that we should not mourn for him, but that while we now at last give his body back to nature, we should glorify his spirit as that of a god forever."
Yeah, so just make sure that there's no ambiguity there. And he'd spent the last 6 chapters of Dio reiterating everything that Augustus had done for Rome in that time. He built this, he conquered this.
Yeah, so it's kind of like a recapitulation of Augustus's own epitaph that he had carved on
the tablet. Yes, yes, yeah, he read it out.
Yeah, that epitaph in itself is a kind of, this is my case for deification, you might argue. And it works, of course. This kind of gets us back, I think, to that original idea that deification is like a thank you for having been a saviour or a really impressive figure throughout your lifetime.
Look, I think it's a thank you for that at this point, but it will later on become a thank you for not screwing things up.
Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you for not excessively murdering people.
Yeah, not killing too many senators. Yeah, absolutely, because it becomes more normalised. Yeah. Therefore, unless you do something really bad, you will be deified as an emperor.
So Tiberius, much like Augustus, is making sure that Augustus is deified so that it solidifies his position and makes him the son of the god. Tiberius builds temples to Augustus throughout the Roman Empire. So we've got a few of them around. I know from a recent win in Rome that there is one in Pula. They go far and wide. Yeah. And this is beneficial to Tiberius. It legitimizes him.
Yeah, and it kind of spreads that throughout the empire that Augustus is a god and that now our emperor is the son of a god.
It also comes up during there were treason trials.
Yeah, one of the less savory parts of Tiberius's reign and other reigns too, but Tiberius is noted for this, for having spies around who will tell him when there are crimes against the emperor, and so saying things against the emperor.
Yeah.
And one of the crimes that gets reported by Suetonius, I think it is sacrilege charges against somebody who takes coins that bear the image of the deified Augustus into the toilet.
Yeah, right.
The punishment for treason is death. So
just for having pocket change.
Yeah. So despite this taking up of Augustus as a deified figure, Tiberius is not keen to deify his mother when she dies in 29 CE. He does not have Livia deified. And everyone is expecting this because she is the Augusta. And people like Ovid seem to be looking forward to it. She's not deified until Claudius becomes emperor.
Really? Okay.
So he's not deified until 41 CE. He's her grandson.
Yeah.
And there are various ways of reading this. Tacitus, for example, makes out that that Tiberius just hated his mother and thought she was overbearing and wanted to get away from her.
Mm.
But it's also possible that it was just seen as too much too soon.
Yeah. Right,
Augustus, fair enough. But do we need to extend this to the likes of women? Or do we need to be extending this throughout the imperial family? He shows no interest in it. And clearly he could have done it. I think there would have been senatorial will for it, but he does not allow it to happen.
But also this is maybe another example of the process of deification being figured out.
When we get to Hadrian, you know, everyone in his family and their dog is getting deified. His mother-in-law just hangers on all over the place. So it becomes more normalized for sure.
Mm. Okay, so well, let's continue later emperors then now as well. Tiberius is not deified.
There's been Julius Caesar and Augustus. It's hard to say that it's become normal by this point. Julius Caesar wasn't even an emperor.
Mm.
Tiberius, not a popular emperor. Remember, he self-exiled for the last years of his reign.
Mm.
And there may not have been much senatorial will at all to deify him. But Caligula seems to aim at deification during his life, according to some sources. Seems to see himself as a kind of analog to Zeus or Jupiter.
Mm.
Deifies his sister Drusilla after she dies.
Really?
Yeah. So there is an early imperial family, a woman deified. That is taken away after Caligula dies.
Does that get undone? Yeah.
It does. She gets undeified. Yeah. And Caligula very much does not get deified after his murder in 41.
So let me consult this handy book that I've got here. Who's this by? Dario Calamino. And this is Defacing the Past, which ties in with a British Museum exhibition at some point. And thank you, Kaelin, for giving me this, because he accidentally ordered two copies for himself and then moved to Germany and didn't want to take it with him. So it's got here a timeline of deified and damned emperors. So Caligula is not formally damned. So we can damn him as much as we like, but there's an actual process.
Deification is a way of continually commemorating somebody, putting them up amongst the gods, elevating them. Whereas damnatio memoriae, which we'll talk about elsewhere, is the exact opposite. It's a way of cancelling their memory.
Yeah. As you say, we'll go into that more detail in the next episode of Emperors of Rome when we talk about damnation and damnatio memoriae, which is the same thing, just in Latin. So as far as the later emperors go, they very much quickly solidify a process of, as we've said, if you don't screw up, you are essentially deified.
Yeah, and also, well, Claudius is deified. He's not necessarily a popular emperor.
Yeah,
but part of the reason he's deified is to legitimize his heir, Nero, his stepson.
And that's what it's about. It's about the next emperor wanted to be legitimate, to be able to say that I'm the son of the god. There's also a rehabilitation aspect to it. And sometimes in cases, there is a genuine love of the people, where the people just, you know, think that you were a great emperor and expect this to happen.
Yeah, they clamor for it.
Especially once you get out of the Julio-Claudians, this is a done and dusted process of people love you, Senate says you're deified, it's useful to the next emperor for you to be deified. Off we go.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting with Claudius that even though he is deified and the whole process is gone through properly, we have a work probably by Seneca, Nero's tutor, making fun of that process, the apocolicentosis, which means the pumpkinification of Claudius. So there seems to be an idea there that they did it for political reasons, but they weren't taking it seriously. They took the piss out of it. Can I say that?
Yeah,
sure. They took the piss out of it in private.
Mm.
Although then that work is published, so I'm not sure quite how private it was. But yeah, there seems to be a kind of real double line going on Claudius's deification.
So it hasn't been completely normalized at this point, maybe?
You could argue that work in particular and the process with Claudius means there's still some questioning of it going on.
Yeah.
That whether this should occur as a matter of course, but that is going to be very quickly swept aside.
Mm. After there's a civil war and the year of the four emperors, we get into the Flavian dynasty, and that's where Roman emperors just really start to nail down what it means to be deified.
Yeah.
So you've got Vespasian deified. You've got Titus, emperor for 2 years, deified.
Both popular.
Both popular. Yeah, sure.
In the Colosseum.
Yep.
You could argue Vespasian saved Rome from civil war by winning that civil war.
Sacked Jerusalem. Yep. All good things.
Exactly. Bring a lot of wealth into Rome.
Sure.
Very bad from the Judean point of view.
But let's not go there. Rome. Yeah. Okay. But then you've got somebody who destroys the reputation of the Flavians, don't you? So you can't deify.
Domitian is the third Flavian emperor, and he is murdered in 96. Deeply unpopular with most of the Senate. And yeah, they're not going to deify him. Mm. I mean, they've got rid of him so they can bring in a whole new crop.
Yes. So at that point, Antonine Dynasty.
The five good emperors.
You get the five good emperors.
So-called. They're all deified. So you get Nerva, Trajan, Hadrian, Antoninus Pius, Marcus Aurelius. The good run of 100 years.
Yeah. So do you want to have a word about Hadrian and what he does with deification? You said all members of his family are essentially, you get a deification, you get a deification.
Look, Hadrian seems to be, we've moved on. We've moved through a lot of history there. Go back and listen to the podcasts on those emperors if you need to know more. I mean, he's somebody who's quite revolutionary in lots of ways with his whole traveling through the empire. He deifies female members of his family, including those who are not even blood relations, so his mother-in-law being an example. And he deifies his boy love,
Antinous,
which is really going outside of the legitimate family, as it were. Not even somebody he can marry into, and not a Roman either. He's a Greek. And that is probably, given that Hadrian was mocked for being the little Greek, there were probably questions raised about that, but it's not taken away.
No, and that one in particular seems to have been, you know, quite popular throughout the East. Can I just put it that way?
Absolutely, yeah. Hadrian seems to have been genuinely distraught by Antinous's death, but also it's quite a good political move in the East, and he remained popular there throughout. This does kind of set a train for, so when Antoninus Pius dies and his wife Faustina, both of them are deified. There's a temple to both of them.
Yeah.
The divine imperial couple becomes a thing at that point too.
And it's interesting that do you want to talk much about the Severan dynasty? We're getting out of your comfort zone there. It's interesting that when Commodus dies, real piece of work that nobody is sorry to see the end of, he is damned.
Yeah, he gets the damnatio memoriae. He's not going to be deified. So, we're kind of expecting one or the other by this point. Either you're an emperor who gets deified, or you've really messed up and you get damnatio memoriae.
But the coda to that is that when Septimius Severus becomes emperor, it's beneficial for him to promote himself as the son of Marcus Aurelius. So by doing this, he's got to accept Commodus as his brother, and he deifies Commodus in retrospect and says, "This is my divine brother." He wasn't all that bad. Then going forward, and we will talk about this more in the next podcast, you've got the Severan dynasty mostly being deified. Even Caracalla is deified because it's beneficial to the later emperor after him to say, look, Caracalla was my dad. He wasn't. Elagabalus was not the son of Caracalla, but still deify his father, quotation fingers. Yeah. But then you've got Geta, who is probably one of the more famous examples of damnatio memoriae, which we will discuss on another. So how does the concept of deification kind of culminate into a grand finale for the Romans?
Well, I mean, it's not going to survive Christianity, is it, basically? Deification is a problem for them. And it's been a problem from early on for monotheistic religions. So, you know, the whole attempt to put the statue of the emperor in the temple in Jerusalem. That's the clash that happens, all right? Which is not to say that everyone just accepts Roman rule throughout the empire easily. But in the religious sphere, it's the monotheistic religions that cannot cope with the pagan pantheon, and the deification of the emperor makes him part of that pantheon.
Yeah.
So there's kind of an extra wedge there for monotheistic peoples that they find it harder to accept Rome, because part of accepting Rome is accepting that these leaders, and in a way it's almost more important than worshipping Jupiter and Minerva, because rejecting the emperor as a god is also a political move.
Yeah, so saints fine, emperors no. Okay.
Yeah, and you know, there is an argument that saints, partly they take over where the deified Roman emperors are cut off.
Yeah.
So in the 4th century...
So we've got Constantine.
As people probably know, Constantine the Great, as he's known, becomes Christian and converts to Christianity. It's in a way sort of added to the realm of Roman religions, but throughout the fourth century, it's going to become the Roman religion.
Mm.
And there's an idea from this point on that the emperor has to be inferior to a god, but they kind of play around with it so that the rule is that he rules by divine grace. So mm-hmm. God is making him the ruler. So it's not that everyone's the same under God, which I think might be one of the tenets of Christianity, but the emperor manages to swing it so that he's the one who's in charge on earth, I guess, with temporal concerns.
Yeah, and I mean, kings do that as well. You know, by the grace of God, I rule this country.
Exactly. But, you know, it didn't get cut off immediately by Constantine, because if he converts, it's, you know, it takes a while for the Roman Empire to convert. It takes a long time. Mm. And there is still this habit of deifying. So there's an attempt to deify Constantine by a municipal government. In Umbria in Italy, a town called Spello, which was Ispellum in antiquity, we have something called the Ispellum Rescript, which shows that Constantine granted the city of Ispellum a temple to be built for the gens Flavia, his family.
Mm.
So that's a temple to his family rather than him specifically, and that the city itself was named Flavia Constans in his honour. So he's sort of allowing a certain amount, but he doesn't want them to sacrifice to him. So Constantine seems okay with them praying to his family. It's like he's sort of keeping them happy by letting them do that. So when Constantine's son, Constantius II, was deified by the Roman Senate at his death, they were going along with those traditions of the Roman state, but it's something that's dying out because he's the last to be deified.
But still the fact that it's happening by the decree of the Senate at that point.
Mm. It's not just the will of the people.
It's not just the will of the people. That's essentially the last gasp of the whole system.
Yeah, the system ends with him, though. It actually dies out much quicker than you might expect, I guess because it has to be officially sanctioned. And once the emperor decides that this doesn't fit with the tenets of Christianity that are being adopted, then they can bring an end to it.
That's Dr. Rhiannon Evans, Associate Professor in Classics and Ancient History at La Trobe University, and you have been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, you can subscribe in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your local friendly neighborhood podcatching service. Please leave a review. I do actually read them, and they help keep off the chill of the pandemic. You can like the Emperors of Rome on Facebook, and you can follow both myself and Rhiannon on Twitter. Rhiannon is at Dr. Rhiannon Evans, I am at Nightlight Guy, and the podcast is at Rome Podcast. In the next episode of Emperors of Rome, we flip the coin over and we have a look at Damnatio Memoriae. So until then, I'm Matt Smith, you've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.